we're moving development into places where it's never been before, and they deserve to be evaluated on their own merits, not with a cookie cutter approach.
Environmental groups fight a plan to ease oil and gas permitting in the Arctic. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a startup proposes building a massive data center on the North Slope, leading to many questions.
One is that this has never been done in Alaska on this scale, and certainly not on the North Slope.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Alaska's oil and gas lobby wants to expedite development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Just days after the Alaska Oil and Gas Association petitioned the government for a new, faster permitting process, the Bureau of Land Management obliged, announcing it intends to write a new rule for the reserve. Drilling opponents call it a corporate giveaway. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
The idea is to avoid bureaucratic redundancy, because in a blockbuster lease sale in March, nine companies won leases on nearly 200 tracts in the petroleum reserve on the North Slope. Rather than have each company apply to the BLM for permits for each production site, the industry is asking that the agency make a rule granting permits as long as certain conditions are met.
Our goal here is to create greater certainty and consistency for what we view as routine development activities in the petroleum reserve, but continuing along strong environmental stewardship when we do it.
Steve Wachowski is president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, a trade group that proposed the process. He says the BLM could do one big environmental impact study covering the basic things that make up a production site.
So limited amount of gravel roads, development pads, drilling pads, that could be looked at, studied, with potential to be codified in the rule so we could go right to BLM and get a permit.
The request comes at a time when permitting reform has become a national cause. Producers of fossil and renewable energy alike are pushing Congress to make some changes because the laws that slow oil drilling also delay transmission lines and solar farms. But one person's red tape is another's meaningful environmental protection. While Congress mulls a compromise, the Alaska oil industry is proposing a special process for the NPRA. As AOGA proposes it, a company would apply for a permit in the reserve specifying how many wells it wants, the size and locations of the gravel pads, and other construction. If the BLM decides it meets the definition of a production site, as described in the rule, the permit would be granted within 60 days. Wachowski points out it would only apply to BLM permits. Development near waterways would still require permits from the Corps of Engineers, he says, and then their state and North Slope borough permits.
So there still is a whole host of other permits and opportunities for public input.
Environmental advocates in the North Slope community of New Iqsaic call it a gift to industry. Matt Jackson of the Wilderness Society says the approach wrongly assumes that one part of the NPRA is the same as any other.
We're moving development into places where it's never been before, into places with really important surface and cultural and subsistence values, and they deserve to be evaluated on their own merits, not with a cookie cutter approach.
Ann Jackson says the umbrella permitting concept doesn't take into account the cumulative effects of multiple projects.
If you have one drill pad, you know, a caribou can just go around that. If you have 10 drill pads on a line stretching out for miles and miles with pipelines and roads and power lines, that makes a much bigger impact to the caribou moving to where they need to go.
The BLM has kicked off a public scoping period for an environmental impact statement that would precede the rule. It's underway until July 6. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A startup with Alaska roots wants to build a massive data center on the North Slope, closer to natural gas supplies it would use to generate the enormous amount of electricity the center needs. Stack Energy's proposed $500 million data center, with a footprint of more than a square mile, would support artificial intelligence and cloud computing, according to recent reporting by the Northern Journal. So far, the idea exists only on paper, but the company has secured the state's preliminary approval to lease land off the Dalton Highway. And according to Northern Journal reporter Nat Herz, Stack Energy has suggested it would be able to avoid some issues that data centers in the lower 48 have faced.
There's like a pretty significant backlash against AI and specifically the sort of data center construction and the environmental like impacts and resource use, right? Like significant demand on water, on power, especially. Like I think there's a big problem in the lower 48 where basically the demand for electricity is spiking because of the build out of these facilities in a way that's like raising electricity prices for people across the country. On the North Slope, there is a huge supply of natural gas right now that's not being used. This facility would not be connected to the rest of Alaska's grid. They would basically be like self-generating power off of this abundant resource on the North Slope, presumably at a fairly competitive price, because right now there's no additional sort of demand for this natural gas that they'd be competing with. And then, you know, again, there's sort of abundant land. And then another one of the arguments that the state and the company are making is that a lot of the sort of energy and resource demand for these facilities in the lower 48 is from cooling. And on the North Slope, you know, you have a below freezing average temperature over the course of the year, I believe. And so they're saying that's like a major comparative advantage where they'd be using what they expect to be 90% less water than a facility in the lower 48.
A lot of the hurdles, I would imagine, have to do with this plan being on the North Slope and kind of far away from the other, you know, centers of industry in the state.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of big question marks. And one is that this has never been done in Alaska on this scale, and certainly not on the North Slope. And so I think you can bring in engineers and people doing kind of pencil pushing and calculations and planning and say, like, we have this concept, it's compelling in all these ways. And then I think you bring it to investors and or the like AI companies and say, okay, you know, time to invest. And they're like, there's no basis that this works and hasn't been done before, so we might not trust it. I think that's like a sort of big overarching question here of, is there sort of trust that this would work and is there real interest in doing it? And I think we don't know. That the company sponsoring this project has not really been forthcoming about like whether they have sort of customers or investors lined up for this product. And then, yeah, I mean, I think there are also some questions about, does the bandwidth and the connectivity from the North Slope, are there issues with what they call latency and sort of the lag time? But yeah, and then there's some other questions around like the turbines that are used to generate power from natural gas. Like there's a big backlog for those turbines right now just because there's a major increase in natural gas power generation and demand. And so in some cases, they're saying like as much as 7 years. And so, you know, can this company get those natural gas turbines? Like those are some obvious questions as well.
Let's talk about the company. It's Stack Energy. Who is Stack Energy?
I don't think a lot is known about the ownership necessarily, but the woman in charge, Sparrow Mahoney, she grew up in Alaska and has had, I think, some involvement in sort of startup type businesses and in cryptocurrency. Specifically, she was involved in the Iditarod's push into cryptocurrency a few years ago. And then more interestingly, in the past year or so, they brought on some people who are like veterans of Alaska's energy and sort of business world. So you've got a former State Natural Resources Commissioner John Boyle, who's working for the company, Jim Schein, who is an attorney who used to be a special assistant at the Department of Natural Resources. And these are presumably folks that are familiar with the needs of navigating the land use and permitting process that this company has to go through. So you've seen them kind of staff up with some people who have some significant experience, which is, you know, I think at least one indication that they're sort of a serious, credible company. But then I think on the flip side of that, again, it's one thing to be paying a handful of people even competitive six-figure salaries, and it's another thing to raise the hundreds of millions of dollars that you need to actually build a project like this. So
that was Northern Journal reporter Nat Herz. You can find his full story about a proposal to build a data center on the North Slope at northernjournal.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 7 students who survived the devastating fall storm in Western Alaska celebrate high school graduation.
I know we want to graduate back home, but we're not. Just be happy that we are able to walk tonight.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Ketchikan expects to see the most cruise ship passengers ever this summer, over 1.6 million. In response to the industry's boom, local developers are building attractions, restaurants, and breweries in Ward Cove, a new docking site for cruise ships north of town. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, the project aims to maximize tourism dollars while alleviating congestion downtown.
You're going to be cheering on, USA.
Donning extra tough boots, brown Carhartt overalls, and a plaid flannel shirt, Joe Williams greets a family who just stepped off the Norwegian Bliss cruise ship.
Welcome to our first guests at our new facility. Welcome, welcome. Oh, yeah.
Williams, also known by his stage name, Lasagna Joe, is the MC of the Great Alaskan Lumberjack Show, a campy contest where teams of lumberjacks compete in various chopping games with axes and chainsaws. The rodeo-style show in downtown Ketchikan draws in thousands of cruise ship passengers each year. But today, Lasagna Joe and the rest of the lumberjack crew aren't downtown. They're 7 miles north in Ward Cove for the inaugural production at a second, larger venue. It comes after cruise ships began docking in Ward Cove about 5 years ago.
And it's one industry in Alaska that we don't have to extract something to sell out into the world.
That's Rob Shear, president and owner of the Great Alaskan Lumberjack Show. He says tourism stimulates the local economy by generating revenue and creating jobs.
You know, it's not timber, it's not oil, it's not gold. The only thing we're selling is memories, and they can take it, and it doesn't, you know, we don't have to cut down a tree for a memory.
The two-berth terminal at Ward Cove, which sits at the site of Ketchikan's former pulp mill, will see about 130 cruise ship stops this summer, about 20% of the total. And for the first time, passengers won't have to bus to downtown Ketchikan to catch a show or grab a meal. That's because several new businesses are opening this summer in Ward Cove to ease overcrowding downtown and cater to passengers. Joe Duca is with Alaska Port Innovations, which is developing part of Ward Cove. He says the new businesses breathe life into the old mill and bring a taste of downtown Ketchikan to Ward Cove.
When I was asked to get involved, seeing some of the horrible reviews of the port, because nobody wanted to be there. And so that was really what spurred a lot of this in developing that area.
On a bluff that overlooks the Tongass Narrows, workers are busy putting the final touches on Fireside Feast. That's an outdoor dining experience with covered canopies and open fire cooking set to open this summer.
Here in Alaska, you know, we do the beach bonfires all the time. It's my favorite thing.
That's General Manager Justin Haggard. He enjoys the camaraderie and food associated with Alaska bonfires, and wanted to offer that experience to people who are only in the state for a short time.
We've been here developing for the past month or so, like up here every single day, and we'll get bald eagles flying over. You know when the whales are through that you'll be able to see them perfectly from here. It's just a cool spot, man.
Haggard says he's wanted to develop a culinary experience like this for years, and finally found the right space to do it about a year ago. He says visitors can expect to dine on smoked salmon chowder, wild game, and more. Haggard and his wife own Alaska Spud in downtown Ketchikan. He says the city is lacking food options and wants to provide an alternative for visitors, especially those whose first taste of the island is in Ward Cove.
Yeah, I feel bad for all of them having to be bussed into town when we have this beautiful space here that just needs a little love and development. And we're in the process of that right now. And I really want to bring, you know, more money to Ward Cove, to this area. You know, I think it's the beginning of something really, really cool.
Also in the works at Ward Cove is a zipline adventure park set to open this summer and a combination brewery, distillery, winery. Duca, who's helping to revitalize the area, says other future developments may include a boardwalk, a jewelry store, and lodging. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Hunter Morrison.
A group of Alaska veterans traveled to Washington, D.C. last month to visit memorials built in their honor. The trip was also an opportunity to reflect on what it meant to come home from America's past wars. For Alaska Native Vietnam War veteran George Lindoff from Hoonah, a proper homecoming came decades after his service. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
When George Lindoff returned to the U.S. in 1971, after fighting for his country in Vietnam, he was not met with a warm welcome. Instead, there were anti-war protesters.
First time we landed in San Francisco, they were cussing at us, spitting at us, carrying signs saying baby killers.
And there weren't just protesters at the San Francisco airport. Police were there, too.
In California, the police were looking at us like we were going to attack them, protesters.
Lindoff may have physically left Vietnam and the war, but the war never left him. Lindoff's brother, James Lindoff, who died in 2024, was also drafted and sent to Vietnam. The war had a lasting impact on both of them.
You try to forget what happened over there, because you were not raised to go out and be killed.
More than half a century after he returned from Vietnam, Lindoff had the opportunity to revisit that chapter in his life, this time with the goal of healing. In April, Lindoff joined a group of veterans from all over the state, and they went to D.C. through an organization called Last Frontier Honor Flight. The volunteer nonprofit sends veterans to the nation's capital to visit monuments and memorials built in their honor at no cost to the veterans. While in D.C., though, Lindoff had a mild stroke and had to be hospitalized. He missed most of the trip, as well as the big welcome home in Anchorage. That's an important part of the Honor Flight trip, to give the veterans the welcome home they never received. So Lindoff's niece, Shannon Bible, made sure he still got one.
He's my uncle, my mom's brother. She would have done this if she was here. He didn't get the welcome home when he came back from Vietnam, so giving him something he deserves.
Bible organized something in Juneau, where Lindoff flew to before continuing on to Hoonah. She didn't have a lot of time to prepare.
I put a post on Facebook that I wanted to pull something like this off, and it was amazing how fast everything, on such a short notice, with the power of having Hoonah people here in Juneau, we were able to pull this together.
About 40 people gather outside the security doors on the second floor of the Juneau airport. Family is there, community members, friends, members of the Alaska National Guard, even local police officers. His grandniece is there with her dance group. They start playing as Lindoff appears through the security doors. A Last Frontier Honor Flight volunteer pushes Lindoff in his wheelchair, accompanied by his son-in-law, who went on the trip. Lindoff's right foot immediately starts tapping to the singing and drumming, his fingers braided together on his lap. He looks content. The crowd applauds. After the drumming and singing ends, people go up to Lindoff to shake his hand, welcome him home, and say thank you. The scene is emotional.
I'm real happy that he's getting some recognition, you know. He's real bashful, but I'm glad to see this. Yeah.
That's longtime friend Norval Nelson. He knew Lindoff and others from Hoonah who fought in Vietnam before they left and after they came home.
Well, it was pretty hard on all of them, you know, that went over there. And they were in the front lines because they knew how to hunt and track. And
Nelson says when Lindoff returned from war, he was quieter, less talkative, and more jumpy. After the crowd disperses, Lindoff and a handful of others move to the departure area for his flight to Hoonah. There, Lindoff says he was surprised that so many people showed up. He knew some people would be there, but he didn't expect the drumming and singing, the big production, the type of welcome home many think a decorated veteran like him deserves. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The popular Gold Belt tram in downtown Juneau will remain closed as it undergoes repairs and inspections, according to Gold Belt CEO McHugh Pierre. The tram has been closed since late April after a tram car came to an abrupt halt at its bottom terminal. The incident injured two employees. The tram was scheduled to reopen Sunday, but Pierre says that's no longer the case.
There is no date set to open until we are certified safe to operate. We don't know when that date will be. We anticipate opening this year. This is not a lost season, but we want to make sure that, again, safety is the priority, the only priority.
Pierre declined to discuss the status of the injured employees or go into detail about what caused the incident, but he says Gold Belt is working with multiple entities to do inspections and repairs to avoid problems in the future. The closure comes nearly a month into the 2026 cruise ship season. The tram is a popular visitor attraction that brings hundreds of thousands of riders up and down Mount Roberts each year. Pierre says while the tram is not running, Gold Belt has reopened its terminal, which has a coffee shop and gift section. He says Gold Belt is working to retain as many seasonal employees as it can during the closure. Well, there probably hasn't ever been a high school graduation ceremony in Anchorage like this one. Yes, there was pomp and circumstance at the Alaska Native Heritage Center on Monday night, but it was a marriage of village and city life that came about not by choice, but because of a storm last year that ravaged coastal communities in western Alaska. For the families who were forced to leave, it's been a healing journey. And as KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the graduation of 7 students marks an important milestone along the way.
That was some storm that we went through.
A storm that Dungik Ikuhak says was still very much a presence in this room.
It was exciting, scary, but I don't want to go through it again.
The graduates know Dungik by his nickname Dun. He was their coach and counselor even before they were evacuated to Anchorage. Like his students, he still feels the trauma of that night in Guigillinock when floodwaters lifted his home off its foundation and carried it away.
Our house went really fast, and when the wind gusts, our house would turn around 1.5 spins.
Dunn hovered over the students as they donned their caps and gowns, whispering words of encouragement.
I know we want to graduate back home, but we're not. Just be happy that we are able to walk tonight as one, as survivors.
If you closed your eyes, you could almost imagine that you were back in the village with the sound of small kids and babies in the backdrop. Picture people crowded into a small school gym, balloons and banners covering all the walls. So different from the elegance of the Alaska Native Heritage Center. As the graduates made their way to the stage, they heard the same scratchy recording that would have been played back home. And although she was 500 miles away from Kipnuk, a wave of emotions rolled over Sophie Paul, waiting for the moment to watch her son Misuk walk down the aisle.
Several times he wanted to say, Mom, I want to be done. So, no, Miss, I want to see you graduate. You can pull through. And here he is going to graduate, representing Kipnuk.
Dunn says the love that filled the room surrounded everyone.
There's this saying that's been passed on. Keep loving a person next to you today. Show your love to that person. And you saw the love coming out from each person, young and old alike.
Dunn made sure that the rose ceremony, a tradition from Kipnuk and Guigillinock, would be incorporated into the Anchorage graduation, when each student is given 5 roses to hand out one to each of the 5 people who have helped them on their journey.
I am going to give my first 2 roses to my parents because they helped me get here.
Jason Dan Lewis gave the remaining 3 roses to other family members. He says they all helped to motivate him finish high school. After the storm, he went to East High, which has 2,000 students, 10 times the size of his school in Guigillinock.
I want people to know that there are a lot of students who came a long way, especially all the way from the villages and adapting to the city. I want them to know that they did an awesome job adapting to the changes.
To our graduates, I hope you carry the same courage, strength, and resilience into the next chapter of your lives that brought you to this moment today.
Jamie Galvin, the Director of Indigenous Education for the Anchorage School District, helped to shape the ceremony, one meant to reach beyond handing out diplomas, but also remind the graduates of their roots back home.
Never forget where you come from, the communities that raised you, and the strength that you carry within you. You will now turn your tassel from the right side to the left side. And this now symbolizes that you guys are all graduates. Congratulations.
A ceremony that was more than a graduation, but a homecoming. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Hunter Morrison in Ketchikan, Lisa Fu and Clarice Larson in Juneau, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.